Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Most of what scientists do happens behind closed doors. We don't usually get to see it.
Here we have a specimen, BAQS.
Their work is methodical, repetitive, often solitary.
Sorry, just give me one second.
Staring into a microscope, preparing samples, crunching numbers on a computer.
We're getting hundreds of millions of reads, and so there's a lot of going bleary-eyed looking at data files.
You can now see it's puckered up in the top here.
This particular brain, it's been in formalin.
Maybe they go a little stir-crazy in there sometimes.
Small dots. Everywhere.
A machine that's like pipetting a lot of reagents. It's the machine, the sound of the machines.
Lots of things that they have to do are mundane, everyday tasks that go unnoticed. But thousands of scientists made a decision to make themselves and their work more visible during big protests on Earth Day in D.C. and other cities all over the country. Why take this big step out into the open? What are the benefits? What are the risks? On today's show, we'll talk about becoming visible, whether you want to be seen or not. We meet a researcher who changed how she talks about her work after she was mocked by a really popular television host. We track the fate of accidentally unearthed skeletons, and we learn why you should definitely stay away from the flashiest frogs in the rainforest. Let's start with scientists being out and visible. When Donald Trump was elected president, many scientists became very nervous. Chatter started online almost immediately in Facebook groups and message boards. Many people perceived him as an anti-science candidate. And almost right after the inauguration, people started organizing a march for science. One of the co-chairs of the march, Valerie Aquino, said she felt like scientists had failed to make their case to the public. They had lost the public's trust. And the way to rebuild it was to become more visible.
I would hope that scientists are getting to be more comfortable with doing a little bit more than just leaving data at someone's doorstep and walking away, but really working toward showing that data and themselves to the general public.
Over the last couple of months, Irina Zhurov has been keeping in touch with scientists. She wanted to find out what that journey was like, some of the motivations, some of the missteps, as they prepared to take their cause public.
Janine Krippner is finishing up a PhD in volcanology at the University of Pittsburgh. She studies pyroclastic flows, very fast, hot masses of rock, gas, and ash that race down a volcano during an eruption, destroying everything in their path. She wants to stay in the U.S., eventually get citizenship and work. Aside from her science studies here, she's also had a steep learning curve in U.S. politics, particularly around science.
I'm a bit new to it, but there seemed to be a lot more support, or at least a feeling of support, more so with Obama than there is now. So I definitely noticed a difference leading up to the last election.
That's made her reflective of her role in science. She got into volcanoes at a young age.
But I didn't think it was a real job until I was 13 years old, and in a geography class, our teacher went over what a volcanologist is. And it was at that moment I sat back in my chair and thought, oh my goodness, that's what I am. And that's been the path on life I've been on since then.
Now she wants to educate kids and advocate for science in addition to doing research. I first talked to Janine in February, about a month after President Trump's inauguration. She said she knew she'd go as soon as the idea for a march for science started floating around.
It's absolutely an instant, I'm going.
It'd be her second march ever. The first was the Women's March the day after inauguration.
I think it's empowering. There's a lot of scary things going on, but a lot of people are finding voices that they didn't have before.
Several people in her department at Pitt plan to march together. Becky Tischerman, a bubbly PhD student, was one of them. Becky studies water flow and quality in cities. At the time, she thought of it as solidarity. She didn't think her own work would be threatened.
I mean, I'm in the sector of water, and that is something that a lot of people can agree on that we need. So hopefully for me, my job prospects wouldn't go away.
I talked to the women again about a month later, in March, after President Trump introduced his budget proposal.
Honestly, at first, I didn't want to read about it.
Trump proposed massive cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as other science-heavy agencies, like NASA, which funds Janine's research.
I think I'm a bit numb to it all now, which is a shame.
Becky, too, said it'd been a tough month.
I know, maybe this was, again, naive, but I was kind of hoping for the first 2 months of the Washington administration that whatever they said that they were going to do, they weren't exactly going to do it. With seeing the budget plan and seeing all the regulations they're trying to get rid of, I mean, they're definitely doing it.
The politics were draining her, but she also got some other bad news. One of her research grant applications had been denied. She was becoming less sure of clean water's universal appeal.
Yeah, I mean, this semester's just been so hard, and maybe I'm just getting more jaded this over the past month, but it's looking like the higher ups there in the administration don't really see it as a priority.
The significance of the march evolved for her in that time.
I think this march is very important for scientists to get out. And I've been hearing from more and more friends saying, are you going to this? Should I come? And I'm like, yes, go. The more people, the better.
Pretty much like right here.
Welcome everyone, to March for Science Earth Day 2017!
I met up with Becky and Janine on the Mall in Washington, D.C. at the rally before the march. Everyone in their group wore science-themed t-shirts, some of them pretty DIY. Janine's had a volcano on it. She often wears skirts to public presentations to show young girls that geologists look all different ways.
Yeah, I'm rocking a skirt. Yeah, it's kind of chilly, but that's okay.
It was raining. The driest person at the rally was probably whoever was inside a 7-foot-tall blow-up T-Rex suit. On stage, speakers read various iterations of love letters to science, and Becky started to feel a little better.
You know, I was upset for a while, and so it's nice having this reassurance that, like, people actually care. And I think it's definitely emotional for a lot of us.
80s pop star Thomas Dolby made an appearance to play his hit song. TV personality Bill Nye lit up the rally like Beyoncé might.
Everyone's a Bill Nye fan. He's so close to us.
And as the rally wound down, people politely shuffled towards the march route. The March for Science seemed like a physical manifestation of the panic that had been emanating from various science circles for months. It was the embodiment of people's frustrations with the Trump administration's proposed policies. The cuts to science he floated in his budget, the appointment of Scott Pruitt to the EPA, a man who doesn't seem to fully embrace the agency's mission, Trump's own statements doubting the science around climate change. It was personal for many people. Jobs and research funds are on the line. But Trump's rhetoric and many voters' positive response to it also shook many science people's fundamental worldview. The purity of their intentions had been questioned, and that hurt.
This is my 10th year in university. And if I didn't absolutely love what I do, I wouldn't be doing this. You know, we wouldn't be going tens of thousands of dollars into debt. We wouldn't be facing a job industry that's extremely uncertain, and we do it because we love what we do and what we think it's important. I want to save lives. I want to help people, and that's why I'm here.
It's as if the scientists, for the first time, understood themselves to be misunderstood, saw the need to speak up. As we passed museums and government buildings along Constitution Avenue, Becky talked about the need to explain what scientists actually do.
I hope that
this inspires people who work in science, gets them motivated to communicate what they're doing with everyone. I'm studying rivers, I'm studying volcanoes, here's what's happening with them, here's why you should care. Get rid of the jargon and just like be able to communicate what you're saying so people will care about it.
The rain didn't let up.
I'm happy this place is such a positive atmosphere. Like everyone's trying to keep everyone's spirits up, even though we're miserable in the rain.
Despite the high spirits, the march was distinctly quiet. Even when people try to start up chants, they died out after just a few rounds. The scientists seemed shy or just unsure about their voices. The loudest they got was marching by the EPA building.
EPA! 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 EPA.
I gave an EPA scientist a hug. I feel good.
And then it was like having heard their voices, they liked it. They tried another chant. But it died down quickly. Still, Becky and Janine beamed. What if we had more scientists in elected office than used? What if we communicated our ideas to reporters more often? What if we got involved in our communities?
This is just the beginning for us.
That was Irina Zhuroff reporting in Washington, D.C., and the march was not without critics, including scientists. Some questioned the long-term goals of the organizers. People worried that a politicized front would make the public think that science is driven by ideology rather than data. And there was concern that the march would be a statement against the current administration, potentially making life more difficult for scientists in the years ahead. Here's another issue some scientists have to ponder if they want to voice their opinions on federal budget cuts or maybe the administration's stance on climate change. If they are government employees, they have to be careful.
As long as the scientists are not doing it while they're at work, using their work phone, using their work email, pressuring their colleagues to join them in their political activities.
That's Norm Eisen. He's a lawyer.
Freedom of assembly, the freedom to march, that's a constitutionally protected activity.
He was Obama's ethics czar.
Of course, you have to do it on your own time. You might get in trouble if you march down the main hallway at the EPA with a sign that said, "Down with Trump, he hates science." Don't do that on your lunch break.
And Norm Eisen is an expert on something called the Hatch Act, which comes into play here.
The Hatch Act is a protection that has been put in place in the United States government to make sure that when government officials are exercising the enormous amount of power that they have working in their government offices, they don't use that power for partisan political ends. But what it boils down to is putting up a wall so that when you're working for the government, you're working for the public interest, and whatever you might or might not do in your private, personal time is kept well away in terms of political activity.
Give me some examples of actions that could be, quote, punishable under the Hatch Act. What could get me in trouble as a federal employee?
Well, in every administration, federal employees do get in trouble for violating the Hatch Act, and the penalties can be serious. There are examples, people being suspended, fined, losing their jobs, even prosecuted. Probably the worst examples would be using your job for political coercion. So you have the head of an agency who goes into the offices of staff members or calls them all into a meeting and says, "We've got to get out there and knock on doors to make sure the president is reelected." That kind of pressuring is absolutely forbidden.
What about smaller things? Like, let's say I have a campaign sticker on my car, or I have a bobblehead doll of President Trump on my desk that is not complimentary in nature. You know, what about those little things?
Some of the little things can get you into trouble also. Once a presidential campaign begins, and it has begun in the case of Mr. Trump, he's already started his 2020 campaign, you can't have campaign paraphernalia. in your office. If you think about it, somebody comes into that office who's from a different political party, they're going to feel very uncomfortable. So that applies across the government. So it can be some pretty innocuous behavior that trips Hatch Act wire.
Norm Eisen is a lawyer and co-founder of the watchdog organization Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And earlier on in Irina's report about the march in Washington, we heard the sentiment expressed that scientists feel a new responsibility to win over those who ultimately fund their work. That's us, the taxpayers. They feel like they should talk more about what they do and why it's important. That's certainly true for an evolutionary biologist with a peculiar area of interest. She's been accused of doing frivolous science, and Alan Yu went to visit her.
Biologist Patricia Brennan has been studying animal genitals for a decade. Ducks, bats, dolphins, snakes. And this is what she's thinking about right now.
We don't know anything about whether animals have pleasure, they experience pleasure when they're having sex.
So I traveled 5 hours to her lab at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts to look at dolphin genitals.
So this is a bag that has a sample of a female reproductive tract from a bottlenose dolphin.
It looks a bit like a jellyfish made of glistening red flesh. Within this mass, Brennan is looking for the clitoris.
We would expect that if this is something that the females are using, or that is giving them pleasure during sex, that there should be a lot of nerve presence there.
The problem is no one knows the structure of a dolphin clitoris, so she wants to cut one up and prepare it for an X-ray. She puts the sample on a cutting mat, then she gets her tools and starts cutting away everything that is definitely not part of the clitoris.
This is just ton of connective tissue that we don't really need to worry about.
After about 30 minutes, she comes across something unexpected. There's a little bump where she was expecting soft and squishy fat.
This is like hard and I can really grab it with my... It's like a bundle. It's like a whole bundle.
She leaves that in just in case it's important. There's just a lot we don't know, but maybe you're wondering, why do we care if dolphins like having sex or not? Brennan is a biologist, so she wonders, why wouldn't we care?
We study predator avoidance behavior and locomotion and feeding and singing and coloration. But all of those things literally have evolved for the purpose of keeping an animal alive long enough so that it can have sex.
But critics have made fun of Brennan's previous work on animal genitalia, even some very high-profile critics. Here's Megyn Kelly on Fox News in 2013 mocking the biologist's work on duck penises.
We spent almost $400,000 in a federal study that would look at the size, let's put it that way.
The study was more than about just size, of course, but that moment was a bit of a turning point for Brennan.
When my research was attacked and saying, oh, this is a waste of money, who cares about duck penises and all that stuff, then it became very clear that we were just not doing a good enough job educating the public about why this is important.
Her work is what scientists call basic research. That means she asks questions when she doesn't know how the answer can be applied, as opposed to, say, people who work specifically on curing cancer. So why pay for basic research when we could be spending our entire science budget on curing cancer? Brennan explains that basic research can lead to applied research. Here's her favorite example. In 1979, scientists were studying how baby rats grow, and they realized that aside from food and warmth, the rats also need to be licked.
And it's that mechanical stimulation from the mom licking them that really kickstarts these cascades of chemicals that are responsible for growth. Once they figure that out, what they did is they had a bunch of rats in the basement, right? And they had undergraduate students using a little toothbrush and brushing the little pups every day to stimulate the mom licking and get the pups to grow.
Well, it turns out that what works for rat babies also works for premature human babies. And that's why doctors now know that even though premature babies may have weak immune systems, it's important to massage and touch them.
And that was all because
scientists were tickling rats in the basement, right? And there's no way that anybody would have predicted that there was going to be this kind of application coming out of this project, which is part of the point.
Historian of science Melinda Baldwin says you can make pretty much any basic science sound silly.
If the news media had been around in Galileo's day, they might have run a headline saying something like, crazed philosopher wastes city money, endangers citizens, reporting on his experiment dropping spheres off the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
But she says since so much science is funded by tax dollars, researchers have to think seriously about how to explain their work to people.
You're talking to people who may not be able to pay their electric bill. You're talking to people who may be struggling to pay for childcare. And you need to convince them that their hard-earned money should be funding your project.
Biologist Patricia Brennan says she has fully embraced that part of the job. She talks to anybody who will listen, and she hopes more scientists will do the same.
And if everybody were doing the same all over the U.S., I think eventually we would make a difference. But it's not, you know, it's not one person. It's not Bill Nye. Poor Bill Nye. I feel bad for him.
The science guy can't do it all alone, she says. Brennan is from Colombia, a country that isn't rich and does not fund a lot of basic science. She says America has an advantage because funding basic science can lead to innovation. And if America stops doing that, it could lose its competitive edge.
China is going to overtake U.S. investment in science in no time, in less than a decade. And I think that that's kind of ironic that we are losing our leadership position.
That's a pretty big issue to get into when you really just want to focus on a dolphin clitoris. But Brennan has gotten used to balancing this kind of big picture science advocacy and her own research on animal sex organs.
That's Alan Yu reporting, and here's one more footnote from his visit to the animal sex lab. Here he is casually chatting with biologist Diane Kelly about cetacean penises. That means dolphins, porpoises, and so on.
This is my penis inflation invention.
Oh, wait, say that again?
Cetacean penises are really difficult to inflate, so I built this.
Okay.
Then we used it to pressurize the saline and squirt it into dolphin penises in order to make them erect for this study.
Don't you love how Alan just says, okay? The unflappable Alan Yu. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about becoming visible, stepping out into the open, being seen. We're talking way more these days about the lives and experiences of transgender people. Think Caitlyn Jenner's ongoing media blitz.
There was just always this drive for me to be myself.
Discrimination lawsuits.
The so-called bathroom bill in North Carolina has caused public outcry in and out of the state.
Transgender political candidates.
Made on Tuesday when two transgender women were nominated by Democratic primary voters in Utah and Colorado.
We're also having conversations about getting people access to the right kind of medical care, about the distress some people experience when they don't identify with their biological sex. Psychiatrists now call that gender dysphoria. That name also represents a shift in thinking. It used to be called gender identity disorder. In a lot of ways, this topic is way more visible now, and that change is reflected in our next story. A couple of years ago, reporter Laura Ziegler wanted to follow a teenager going through transition. Laura is in Kansas City, and she had a really hard time finding somebody. But finally, a mom and her 15-year-old seemed to be up for it. They all met, they talked for an hour, and then poof, they just disappeared. They stopped returning phone calls. Back then, parents were ready to discuss the experience, but families didn't want their kids to go public. A lot has changed since then. Laura recently reconnected with one of the families she first spoke with in 2015.
At age 3, Tom and Debbie Jackson's little boy began wanting to wear sparkly shoes and to shop for clothes only in the girls' department. Debbie says they knew they had to do something when their child became sullen and stopped smiling around the age of 4.
And then she got to the point where she just very directly told us, you know, you think I'm a boy, but I'm a girl on the inside.
Debbie thought it might help other families if they heard from her little girl. Her name is now Avery. At about age 7, Avery and her mom posted a YouTube video.
Even though I was a girl, I was afraid to tell my mom and dad because I thought they would not love me anymore and they would throw me out and stop giving me any food or anything.
Back then, Debbie and her husband Tom didn't want me to talk to Avery. But things are different now. This time they invited me over to the house to meet Avery. She and her brother are homeschooled and play video games on side-by-side computer screens.
Get stabbed, nerds.
With pink, blue, and purple hair tumbling down her back, Avery's like many 9-year-olds who have an annoying big brother.
Don't hit me.
Avery's tired of being asked about what makes her different.
I don't know. Don't ask me these questions. I'm just playing a game.
But since Avery's mom said it was okay, I pushed a little bit.
I want you just think about this for 1 second, okay? And then I'll stop annoying you. Okay, I promise.
The thing is, my mom told me you were just gonna come and stop and say hi and talk to her. And this is the thing they always do. It's like I'm the one that always gets the question asked. I mean, I'm not interesting. I'm just a boring person that sits at a computer animating and making games all day. That's really all I ever do.
Avery and her family were out front early with their experience, but that visibility has cost them. The Jacksons say they were kicked out of their conservative Christian church. They lost friends and family. Tom's a chiropractor. He says he's lost almost half his patients. Recently, Debbie Jackson was asked if she'd want to go back in time. On the podcast, How to Be a Girl, Debbie said this.
There's a small percentage of me that says yes, absolutely, in a heartbeat. Take it all away. I wish people didn't know our names. I wish people had never heard of us. I wish we just could go about our daily lives and not have to think about these things.
This January, when Avery appeared defiant and proud on the cover of National Geographic magazine, things changed even more. There were more requests for interviews and pictures. And sometimes that's fine. Avery wants to be a pioneer and role model. But her mom says other times, Avery just wants to fit in.
Now I'm not going to be able to leave the house without people going, oh, there's that transgender girl. So in her brain, everyone's going to be calling her that transgender girl from National Geographic.
Tom, Avery's dad, said at times the attention is frightening. Especially since the November election, they've gotten death threats, messages from white supremacists. They've had their address publicized. Critics have said the Jacksons shouldn't be allowed to raise children.
When we're out in public, I literally look 10 feet in every direction, and we've been out in public before where someone will walk up to us and say, I know who you are. And then you have that moment of panic and fear, and they're like, I absolutely love you guys. You're great.
The Jacksons are learning to live with the costs of their more public life, but experts point out there also are costs for people who feel they're living in the wrong body, but who choose not to transition. Heather McQueen, a former social worker with the Gender Pathways Clinic at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, counsels children and their families. She gives parents this advice.
We look for 3 things, consistence, insistence, and persistence.
She says there are symptoms to watch for.
My child has been extremely depressed for the last 6 months. My child is wearing 3 sports bras, can barely breathe because they're trying to conceal that they have breasts. So that is a concern.
Here's a haunting statistic. Some 40% of people with gender dysphoria will attempt suicide, according to a number of studies. This has motivated Debbie Jackson to step up her public appearances.
Debbie Jackson.
She recently was the keynote speaker at a Planned Parenthood conference. The conference addressed health care gaps for the LGBT community, how to educate providers, and why violence against transgender people is so high. Carmen Xavier, in a conservative blue suit, her auburn hair pulled back in a bun, talked about transitioning late in life.
The fact that I'm in my 60s, there's also a sense of urgency here. It's now or never.
Xavier had been a popular elected official and a prominent community activist. Coming out as a woman has isolated her from professional colleagues and even family. She's lost status and friends. It's clear talking to Xavier she still struggles, but seeing 9-year-old Avery Jackson out there being herself is inspiring.
And isn't it good that the child is becoming bored and irritated by all the attention? She just wants to be her.
That's Laura Ziegler reporting from Kansas City. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Some things become most visible to us when they are gone. When a grove of 100-year-old English elms died in Philadelphia, tree lovers suddenly noticed how central these trees had been to the landscape. For 3 years, tiny bark beetles and fungi infested the trees with Dutch elm disease, so they had to be cut down. They stood in a historic cemetery called the Woodlands, and people there held a funeral.
Trees are stoic, silent, and seemingly eternal.
The first sign was the flagging of the leaves. So the leaves started kind of cupping, and it then kind of quickly spread.
There has always been a spiritual link between man and trees.
My name is Jessica Baumert. I'm the director here at the Woodlands. Because I've known since last spring when they started to leaf out that this was likely going to happen. Couldn't even really, like, unless I had to, like, avoid that section of the cemetery because it was super sad for me to walk over there. You know, lots of other trees on the property, green grass, green everything, but you just saw these four massive dead trees in the landscape. It was very sad. Their height and the way that light filtered through the branches and the leaves of the elm trees because of their massive size was really magical. They've been nicknamed the Grove of Seven Giants, which sounds like it's, you know, coming out of a Tolkien book, and with good reason. You really, it didn't really feel like you were in this world.
Thanks again for coming in.
There's a guest book for folks to sign in and put a little memory of the trees, and then there's a little memorial, little takeaway card.
I love the sound of the way the leaves would, you know, just go sort of like shh.
I think I thought more about the shade than the trees themselves. Like, that's what I'm missing is the shade and the darkness.
Here, Z, go around and raise your green one up.
It's louder. It's going to be a completely new sound environment here on this side of the Woodlands without the trees here.
It used to block, I think, the railroad noise, so now the railroad seemed much more apparent.
For all things can but little stay.
That was a funeral for 100-year-old elm trees killed by an invisible pest. Catalina Jaramillo produced this piece. I recently went to a frog exhibit, and at first, I had trouble spotting any of the animals. It felt like I was just staring into empty terrariums, and there's a good reason for that.
There's four of them in here.
There's four?
There's four. These are Chinese gliding frogs. They are from parts of Asia, and they are designed to blend in with the trees, the leaves, so they're bright green. And if I didn't point out all four, you probably wouldn't be able to see them, especially if they're up in the greener part of the exhibit. They're designed that they don't want to be seen during the day at all. But if a predator happens to stumble across these guys, they actually have one more hidden talent. I don't know if you can see their toe pads or not. There's actually a slight webbing between the digits, and they're able to glide out of the tree and then fall onto another one. They say flying is like a flying squirrel, but it's not technically flying. It's just falling with a little bit of grace.
What is your name?
I'm Rachel Lanning. I'm the zookeeper that comes along with the exhibit.
But this green is amazing how bright it is.
Very, very vividly bright to blend in with all the leaves of the rainforest where they're from.
All right, should we go to another one?
Sure.
Oh, these are cool.
I know, I love
so
them.
What's
Everyone
the...
loves these guys.
I know.
Quite the opposite of blending in.
Right.
So you're looking at four different species of poison dart frogs. Poison dart frogs are probably one of the most iconic frog species. Everyone has heard of the poison dart frogs. And they get their name because on their skin they've got special glands that they store a lot of toxic poison. Some of this poison can be pretty mild where it can make you sick, or there's the extreme of the golden poison frog, and he has enough poison on his back to kill 10 adult human beings in one shot.
What?
Yeah, he is the most toxic animal on this planet.
And why these bright colors? I mean, there's one that's bright blue, green, yellow. They almost look unreal. Is it because they can fend for themselves?
Yeah, so nickname for these guys are the gems of the rainforest because they are so vividly bright you can find just about any color with the poison dart frogs. And it's the opposite of the Chinese gliding frogs. These guys want to stand out. And what they're sending a message to anything that might try to eat it or might try to capture it, it's saying, stay away, I'm warning you, you don't want to do this. It's much like a stop sign or a red light, you know, you better stop or slow down. And if you don't, bad things will happen. In this case, definitely bad things would happen if you tried to eat them.
Huh. So something this pretty, you better stay away from.
Yes, yes. Anything brightly colored is always a good thing to not touch.
Frogs on exhibit at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, thanks to my tour guide, Rachel Lanning. Coming up, construction crews digging into historical ground unearthed a surprising find, and volunteers swooped in to help.
In terms of coffins that we pulled out intact, over 40, I believe.
40 coffins, over 70 bodies, and now what? Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about becoming visible. As a computational geneticist, even one at Harvard, you're not exactly in the national spotlight, usually. But Pardis Sabeti made big waves when her research team did groundbreaking work during the Ebola crisis a couple of years ago. They collected blood from people with Ebola and started to quickly sequence the genome of the virus samples.
The types of things we found, particularly as we kept sequencing, was that we could see that the virus is mutating, could see that it was changing before our eyes, really pushing us to say we have to respond, this is a volatile situation. And we're able to use that information to show that the virus was spreading from human to human.
When Sabeti and her team sequenced the first Ebola genome, they published that data immediately online. And then as they continued to work, whatever they found out, it went up in real time. So they made really important information about Ebola visible to researchers all over the world. To go back to that moment when you were making that information accessible to other people, were you even thinking about what am I doing here? Or did it just feel like this is what we need to do and we need to do it right now?
This is the first time my group had been involved in an outbreak. So we didn't really know what the rules were or the sort of common practice was. To us, it seemed intuitive that we would immediately make our data publicly available. And so we were surprised by the fact that people were surprised. But I do remember a conversation that I had with the trainee in my lab, Stephen Geyer. This was a very big moment for him, potentially professionally. And I went in, you know, to see him and I said, I think that we need to make this data available. And that might mean by making it available that it'll take away from anything we might publish. But fundamentally, if I just published this on the web, like that's what would make me most proud. And Stephen, of course, as I would know he would be, was immediately, 100% on board. It was much more important to help our collaborators on the ground who are truly risking their lives on the front lines. And that was the mission.
When you do that kind of thing, when you publish your data, make it available, tell me in broad strokes how that changes the game. What does that allow other people to do? How does it change how everybody collaborates?
Well, the one thing is basically, you know, a lot of times power to individuals comes from having control over something. If, you know, that once you release the data and everybody can have it, then there's no value to keep others keeping data. And so it's important to just make it so that everyone can contribute. It's kind of basic that you need to have the genome sequence to build diagnostics and vaccines and therapies. And so one of the most fulfilling things that came from that is just a number of people that reached out to us and said, we just developed a diagnostic on your sequences, or are developing a new vaccine in that regard.
What about competition? I'm wondering how this could play out in other areas of science where people want to be first and there is money involved and prestige and ego.
Yeah, I mean, that is always a question. And I try not to be too like idealistic and not logical in the way things need to happen. Like, of course, people have incentives and they have needs and they require resources. And so it becomes really important that we're not saying, hey, everybody has to completely give up all their hard work in this process. Make sure that everybody feels as if giving, you know, out their data or helping the cause is not only the right thing to do, but it works out for them as well.
In terms of Ebola, are we prepared for another outbreak? What was learned from this past crisis?
We learned a ton from the Ebola outbreak. It was a lot of knowledge built on the back of great tragedy, but we have moved forward. We have better diagnostics and more rapid diagnostics for Ebola. We've got vaccines that look very promising. But, you know, we showed that when Zika happened that we once again were sort of scrambling and that there are still a lot to be learned, really reinforcing the messages that came out of this of the working together needs to not just be rhetoric, but needs to be really put to practice and pushed forward.
One last question.
Sure.
You're also in a band?
Yes.
So tell me about that, and how do you find time for that?
I've been in a band since sort of my grad school, med school days, and we've most recently been doing music with the Nigerian and other West African scientists that we work with. So Philomena Ahian is a scientist in Nigeria with an outstanding voice, and so every time she comes here or I go there, we sing together and write music. And so in a lot of ways, it actually bridges what we do. I often talk about the fact that the singing together is the shared humanity that makes us know why we're doing this, that it's a greater cause.
That's Pardis Sabedi. She is a viral geneticist and an advocate for open science. And here she is singing with her band, 1,000 Days, and with Nigerian scientist Philomena Ahen.
Sitting here in this room, watching everything move, I do not know how this city was.
Second and Arch Street in Philadelphia is just a stone's throw from the Liberty Bell. It's in the heart of the nation's first capital. So when construction workers digging on private land unearthed a box of old bones last fall, it sparked a lot of publicity and then confusion. Who did these bones belong to and how should they be handled? As workers drilled deeper, they hit more bones and then coffins. They soon realized they had basically dug up one of Philadelphia's oldest graveyards. Everybody thought this 300-year-old cemetery had been moved about 100 years ago. So now what? A group of forensic volunteers stepped in, and Alana Gordon met up with them and has this report.
Anthropologist Anna Doty with Philadelphia's Mutter Museum was one of the first on the scene.
It was crazy. It was absolutely just, you know, throw on some work clothes and get down there.
Also leading the charge was Kimberly Moran. She's a forensic archaeologist at Rutgers Camden.
We would monitor the backhoe, and then when we saw something kind of appear, we would do our best to recover it, take some photographs, document it very, very roughly, and then remove the remains and put it in a box.
Normally, digs like this span months or years to carefully map and handle what's uncovered. Each detail can hold clues to the stories hidden in these bones. So how long did they have for this one?
Days. It took about a little bit more than a week.
Just a few days to salvage what they could in the freezing cold.
That Friday, we had a horrible snowstorm.
They put out the bat signal, or trowel signal, for backup. In came guys like George Leader.
And so I just went down one day to say, hey, is there anything I can do to help out?
He's an archaeologist with the College of New Jersey.
It was difficult with a backhoe working around you, lots of other jackhammers going on in other parts of the site. You know, it was a very difficult situation to work in.
40 or so volunteers, with the help of the construction workers, unearthed the remains of about 80 people. In the scurry to get every one of them safely stowed away, the remains wound up scattered among three locations. Some are in one of Doty's rooms at the Mutter Museum. others are stashed away at this hidden third-party storage unit somewhere in South Philadelphia.
So we're opening up the plastic on each of these coffins, figuring out which number that individual is, and then measuring the size of the platter that they're sitting on.
Dodie, Moran, and Leader are here weeks after the dig to finally tally what they've got.
22?
Yeah.
Dodie says they're excited, but stressed.
Now that the weather is getting warmer, it's really imperative that we get them out.
But Leader is hopeful.
And I think we're going to find some really interesting things about Philadelphia and ultimately our nation's history.
This next phase will involve new challenges. Excavation was just the first step in gleaning details. Now they'll have to go through the boxes of bones, taking meticulous notes to piece together clues.
You guys already pulled this one out.
Is that dirt that's just going to pop off there? Yeah, I think so.
They're already starting that process at Moran's lab, where the rest of the remains are in temporary storage.
Look at this. Look at this nose.
It's beautiful.
Oh my God.
This is archaeology heaven for them. They're like the kids who found the secret candy drawer. Except for them, it's bones and skulls.
That's a big prominent nose.
That is
here.
That person had a prominent, I believe the scientific word is schnoz.
Ultimately, they'll want to figure out the skeleton's gender, age, and other biological profiles.
Wow.
What do you got there?
It's cool. It's a toothbrush.
For Leader, the king-size Snickers bar is the artifact.
I've never seen a toothbrush like that.
He says you can learn a lot when objects are associated with human remains. This toothbrush is made of some kind of bone. Why would a toothbrush be in a coffin?
Your guess is as good as mine, but it would make sense, though, because we had some remains with some really nice teeth. Yeah.
This entire project is on top of their day jobs. The group has launched a crowdfunding campaign and are looking into grants to do a proper analysis.
But look, here's the pelvis.
Ultimately, the bones will be laid to rest. But before then, Moran hopes to create a field course at Rutgers this summer so students can help out and learn. She says she's curious about what these bones might reveal about the experiences of these long-dead individuals, maybe even their actual identities. It's going to be a lot of work and will involve some archival sleuthing, but it's the kind of mystery forensic archaeologists dream of taking on. And beyond that, Moran sees it as a responsibility.
So it's a wonderful opportunity to really help these forgotten people to be remembered.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Oh my goodness.
Is that
check
hair?
Out, yeah, check out
yeah,
that.
Yeah, look at that.
Wow. Now, that's why I'm getting it cleaned up to see if there's trauma. Is that a femur or a tibia?
Yeah, tibia.
There you go. Look how long that tibia is.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia, where you never know what you're going to find. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhuroff, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. We had help editing from Kate Concannon and help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Tanya English, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. You can find The Pulse on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and while you're there, leave us a review that helps other people find The Pulse, too. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Penn Medicine's Transplant Institute supports WHYY. Penn has been performing kidney, liver, heart, lung, and pancreas transplants for more than 50 years. Penn offers advanced options to help decrease wait times and improve outcomes. Learn more about all the options to help patients live and thrive at pennmedicine.org/transplant or 800-789-PENN. Because your life is worth Penn Medicine. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.